two couple of questions. One was, you spoke about the chimpanzees, and you said that the fact that they couldn't acquire language was proved by the fact that they only learnt four words.
Spoken language, I should have said, of course.
Yeah. Now, I would in fact say that you should dismiss the idea that they did learn four words. I've found that with most, or you know, my observation has been that most of these studies or experiments to teach language to animals like chimpanzees has in fact only succeeded on the basis of
sign
deception.
Language.
Well, there's certainly sign language, but actual spoken language, and you mentioned four words, cup,
yeah,
fuck, and whatever the other one was. These were, I think, probably based upon self-deception and the people carrying out the experiment. In other words, if you listen to a bloody chimpanzee for long enough, you're going to hear four
words. You start
words.
Talking like one.
Well, you start talking like one, but you're bound to hear four words that sound, you know, I mean, if you've ever taught a budgerigar to speak, you know, or a parrot.
Well, that's not the important thing, is it?
No, but all I was going to say is that from the point of view of, I don't think you can prove an argument by saying because only four words were learned by a chimpanzee, the chimpanzees can't acquire language. On the contrary, I think what it would prove is that they can. And so on. I mean, that was the...
Well, it doesn't. You see, the fact is that I should have pointed out also, I agree, that there were other experiments with similar animals, which were very much more successful as far as sign language is concerned. But to this, I must add that the average normal child of 10 has a vocabulary which is far greater than a chimpanzee could possibly accumulate if it lived to a million years. You see, that the point I'm making is this, that whilst it's quite true that it's very, very difficult to separate behaviour from biological attributes, the point I'm making is, nevertheless, the human biological setup, as it were, is unique. It, in itself, gives the basis for conceptual thought and the development of language, a spoken language, because the larynx and the tongue and all the rest of it are in the ideal positions for it, and it doesn't interfere with other physiological manifestations like breathing and all the rest of it. So that has evolved. I mean, whether you like it or not, it's evolved. It's no good people trying to claim that the most essential factor is in fact cultural evolution. As far as we're concerned, it is. But it can only be accomplished when you've overcome the biological barriers. So you see, the reason why I chose, for example, an elephant as an example, an elephant is a mammal, not so far removed from other mammals. If you're looking at it from that point of view, I mean, all mammals, including man, have a lot in common. But of course, there are serious limitations, aren't there, upon what an elephant can do. It'd be very, very peculiar to see an elephant conversing with Steve Coleman, for example, on the question of historical development, something like that. See, this is the point I'm making. So that the average questioner, when they're talking about human nature, they don't really know what they're talking about.
It's just the second question I want to ask. The quote from Richard Attenborough, David Attenborough, climate is just quite a relevant point, but he does mention this thing about changes in the climate happening as a result of human action. I'm pretty well convinced that this is so, but we talk about nuclear, you know, because you're talking about is human nature barrier to socialism, and your conclusion is, well, our conclusion is human behaviour is a barrier to socialism, present behaviour patterns.
Right.
And very often, propagandists put forward the idea that something like a nuclear war is perhaps the most likely reason for human beings not to be able to establish socialism because they would be wiped out. But I think, in fact, the not only the pollution of the atmosphere, but actual changes in the nature of the atmosphere, which human beings could affect, could itself prevent socialism coming about. I'm thinking in particular of recent developments in the Amazon jungle and the forests on the Amazon, where one man, in fact one of the world's richest dollar billionaires, bought up from the Brazilian government a piece of the Amazon forest the size of Wales in order to...
The Mato Grosso, that's called.
Yes, one of the biggest, one of the timber-producing areas in Brazil now, which he has created. Now that was an area the size of Wales in one of the biggest forests in the world, but if that was repeated 10, 20, 100 times over, and there would be room for it without the Amazon forest really sort of having, without it really showing in the Amazon forest, that would certainly affect the amount of oxygen in the air.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, that could be, in fact, something which could cause something that would prevent socialism from becoming a possibility, because human beings could perhaps not survive in that kind of an atmosphere.
Yeah, I'm not in disagreement with these kind of conclusions. Right. The point I'm trying to make is that what they're saying about, well, this is what's going to happen. We're going to all be, the ecology is going to rack and ruin. 20 years' time, we'll probably be rendered, it'd be rendered impossible for us to achieve any kind of a living, and so on. But they're posing the question, unless mankind alters his behaviour. What sort of changes are they talking about? See, we're looking at it and we're saying, right, well, the problems that they're talking about are being man-made. That's undoubted. I mean, the drive on of capitalism is destroying the ecology. The oceans are being polluted. The rainforests are being cut down. And, of course, the people are being decimated, although that doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to upset the ecology. But the point is, they're saying, well, unless it stops, it's going to happen. But how is it going to stop? You see, as insignificant as we are, and as we imagine we are, I'm looking at it that we have the right solution. They haven't. They haven't any solution. They're speculating on something happening. I think that they imagine that God is going to come down or something of that kind. None of these anthropologists. I don't know whether it's because they're not it's not their field, but they do not come to any sociological conclusions. They're talking about society all the time, the development of society, the different kinds of society that existed, and the behaviour as a consequence. And they're saying, well, if mankind doesn't alter his ways, he's going to destroy the habitat. When, of course, it doesn't need to be destroyed, because if it were used properly, it could maintain human beings. So this is my disagreement with them. As a matter of fact, of course, they're doing more to substantiate our point of view than almost anybody in other fields of endeavour. But they do not come to their own correct conclusions, as it were. They don't come to any conclusions. Right, off you go, Jim.
Because if you were a president of environmental pollution going from traffic in areas, shall we say, and the destruction of wildlife, particularly in part of Africa and like that, and they tell us here that the seas, they're talk of preserving the power, so we'll probably make a living for this. But of course, now you have touch on properly the European community, or you got so much surplus production, so you can't dispose of it, and they really are. So, what a futility of capitalism itself here to the Commonwealth, and we're supposed to bring Europe closer together, so far of integration. But it seems to have there's so many different conflicting little nationalistic elements. I would think myself that this was impinge itself on people. I don't think we emphasize enough for this propaganda, that the utter inability of capitalist society to impact in every field, there's this clash of interest, which simply will not allow capitalism to solve the various problems by which it is confronted. Whether it's the environmental, pollution, fishing rights, conservation, and the terrific surplus here of our food.
Don't you think that we do emphasise that in our propaganda, standard and so on? I know we can always improve it, but...
I think we can improve this, and if we do it all the more, it further strengthens our case, that the present system of society, and not only do we want to condemn capital, but we also want to knock these people who've got a one-eyed view of things, CND and the other people who've only got a one-eyed view of things, that deal with this particular problem and everything else will sort itself out, I don't think that this is what we want to emphasize, to knock these people, because you take this, these people, the ecologists, this is the step of it, it's a kind of ability to do it all. But of course, these people, again, as conscious, are looking for the impossible, they're seeking solutions within the framework of permanent capitalist society. And I should say that
this is what the anthropologists are doing as well,
What I've got to say, there used to be in the timber belts people that had interest in the timber. It used to be cut out and get out, but in modern times, even with those companies, that they are replanting back a bit. There's China. For instance, when I looked in China Reconstruct, it shows you where there's all this ugly erosion, and then they terrace it all up and planted trees all up, and it shows you later on very handsome trees. But we get along from that. I remember calling in Liberian, Monrovia in Liberia, with American technology, sand dredges, but they throw all the sand up in one part, and at the channel, and on top of that sand, native soil that they covered all over, and also built a bit of a roadway there. But on both sides of that, whether it's perennial or roots growth, or whether it's seed growth, it could be either one too, it grew just rapidly and made a good harbour and blocked the wind from the sea. About every 3 years they had to throw that out, but that's one thing they are doing. If the companies don't do it, well the government is doing a bit in America, United States, and everywhere like that now.
Yeah, but I think...
Replanting trees, even in England, Corbyn sands up in Scotland.
Yeah, I think that governments are aware to a point, but can they do it as quickly as it's destroyed? I don't think they can. I mean, in the position in Brazil, for example, the government have been very, very concerned about what is going on in the Mato Grosso, but they and other parts, but they haven't been able to prevent it. I know that previously when they cut roads through the jungles in Brazil, that they very rapidly became overgrown. But you see, now what they're doing now, they're involving large-scale capitalist techniques, whereas before they didn't, on such a scale. And the machinery that they've got, they're driving roads through, they're destroying the timber, and you've got these big ranches that are taking over vast tracts of land. Incidentally, of course, they're murdering the Indians as well. They're still murdering them. One of their favourite ways of getting rid of the Indians was to supply them with blankets that had come from a smallpox hospital. That was one of their ways of getting rid of Indians, and poisoning them and shooting them and all the rest of it. This is still going on. Pardon?
And employing Dr. Mengele from Auschwitz as well.
Yeah.
Well, they've done that with the Australian Aborigines
and a few people. Sure, Tasmanians in particular.
But that's not total genocide, because there's a lot of people in see them in Hobart, they still got their old features in them.
No, it's not total genocide, but culturally it is genocide. In other words, there are no Tasmanians existing, and the Aborigines, those that exist, are being transformed into wage slaves. And the same fate would await, for example, the Zaire pygmies in the Congo, and possibly the Kung San in the Kalahari Desert, if it weren't for the fact that the Kalahari Desert is so inhospitable and there's nothing there worth considering as far as capitalism is concerned, they'd probably be on the same road as well. But they're not at the present time.
But in Australia, they want them for station workers anyway, on the cattle station. That incidentally, I find use for them. So they don't want to get rid of them altogether. They want labour on them.
Cowboys.
Stockmen.
Yes, but of course, the obvious fact is that these people forced to stick to the traditional way of life. They don't want any part of that capitalism.
Right, well, they don't, you see. That's what's being destroyed.
Yeah, just, I'm curious about on the question of language, not particularly important rest on it, but if you wouldn't mind answering. The question is this. At what point does non-verbal communication become a language? In other words, what distinguishes a means of communication that rests on words, like, you know, the fictitious one in palm coiled like that, and what becomes a language, what becomes an additional version, roughly at what time did that?
Yeah, well, that is something which I don't think anybody can put their finger on. You see, there is a lot of speculation. For example, it is conjectured, that a kind of sign language preceded the involvement of the spoken language. And of course, language is not merely making certain sounds, it's the ability to convey ideas with sounds that can be understood by the people that are listening. And that is an evolution which obviously has taken quite a lot of time. The general opinion is that it would have been evolved on the basis of man becoming a hunter, because it was necessary to communicate messages by sign language without making any noise, and consequently the general concept is that a kind of sign language preceded the vocal language. Now, what the factors were are factors which are bound up with the kind of direction that the hominid line took. And of course, as things became more developed and more essentially integrated, language developed as a consequence. But the point is that language, and it's very hard to define how the areas and the speech mechanism developed alongside of the purely cultural aspect. It's something which is very, very difficult, because obviously there must have been a reciprocal exchange. One, you know, affected the other. But the general opinion also is that bipedalism, as I pointed out there, bipedalism preceded even the growth of the brain. In other words, hominids were standing upright about 5 million years ago. And this, of course, led to the development of the hands, because the arms were free, and also developed along lines of a much larger brain, which in turn had an effect upon the structure as far as the legs are concerned, because it's a very, very finely balanced manipulation of walking. As the brain got larger, it was necessary for the pelvis to broaden, particularly as far as females were concerned, because the birth channel had to be large for an organism with a big head. And the development of the brain, the organism had a big head, and consequently the birth channel had to enlarge, but this didn't preclude enlarging as far as the males were concerned as well. But it is a fact, anatomically at the present time, that a woman's pelvic structure is larger and in consequence has more pressure exerted on it than a man's. A man can walk much more comfortably because he's slim. That's why Australopithecus afarensis, gracilis, to give it the complete name, and it means that it was much more graceful than the other, Robustus Australopithecus, had narrow hips. And consequently, according to the anthropologists that are interested in biomechanics, they could probably walk much better than modern man, even. But of course, you see, the developments as far as the pelvis was concerned didn't take place, because the brain was only 400 cc. You see, the brain capacity of a chimpanzee is 400 cc. A gorilla is about 100 cc's more, at 500. Australopithecus africanus gracilis, which that was the lighter of the two, was 450, and Australopithecus robustus was 500. Not that the larger brain in regard to these two indicated greater intelligence, because robustus was a much larger animal anyway. And, of course, on the basis of the larger structure, it had obviously a larger brain, not necessarily a better brain. Now, the other hominid, afarensis, which is supposed to be the ancestor of the other two, including also Homo erectus, had a brain capacity of about 400, a chimpanzee's brain capacity.
It's not possible.
I'm not quite sure, the ending of that, whether the brain is large or small. You know, that makes a valid point. The mere fact is that man thinks is enough for me, whether it's small or large. Like the transcript, I find I'm very disturbed, the way that certain contributions are going tonight. Take for instance, we're much concerned about the aboriginal society in South America. Well, no doubt about it. This is an inhuman society. That's all you can really say about it.
No, there aren't.
Come into the real detail.
No, there's nothing here.
What is happening? It's purposeful. The disease clothing was introduced, poison was introduced, and. To me, it doesn't seriously, as far as the socialist case is concerned, do anything towards it. At all times, I take the view, you see, and this is where I fall out, you know, with the lecturer, the speaker, regarding, you know, his sort of an almost agnostic view between pessimistic and optimistic. I find that, you know, that I have to be pessimistic. There's no alternative view. It's a biased view that I must take. And you can't very well take any other bias to remain, you know, in that state, you know, where you're not neither being optimistic or biased, you know. Seems to me, you know, a very state of mind that I can't go along with. You have to take this pessimistic view, you see, because it's the only way, you know, that you're going to disturb other people, you see, by telling you, them that, you know, that they should take a pessimistic view as well, you know, about this inhuman society. Regarding, you know, what speech, its effect on human beings to reason and be irrational, see? Well, this is a sort of a duality, you know, that man, you know, has got into, and he's just got to, as far as I'm concerned, lading, you know, the pessimistic view, that we've got to, you know, encourage people, you know, in that way, to be not a concern to be reason and to be irrational. It's a concern to be pessimistic, you know, and the way the world is going at present time.
Well, if I can deal with that point, because that seems to be your main point, in this attitude of pessimism and optimism, you see, it's got nothing whatever to do with the possibilities of socialism. It's an attitude which is taken up, which is scientifically incorrect. You can either take a pessimistic view or an optimistic view. The people who take the pessimistic view say, yes, in 20 years' time, that's the finish. The world is going towards a direction. You're going to, the religious people will talk about Armageddon, and the scientific people, or the pseudo-scientists, will talk about the ecology falling to bits and hoping that mankind will do something about it. Just hoping, not having anything definite about it. Now, the point that I'm making is this. The optimist, on the other hand, takes the view, oh, yes, well, all these things are terrible, but it'll all come right in the end, even although we do nothing about it. We'll look back and we'll see all the developments, and the ecology is going to pieces, but it'll come right. Man will put it right. Well, you see, this again is a completely unscientific approach. The fact is that there is no guarantee, there is no inevitability about either position. What we are saying is that here you have capitalism, and capitalism is in danger of destroying not only capitalism as capitalism, but the whole of human existence. Because capitalism is a system which has no control over itself, as it were, or not sufficient control over itself to prevent what it's doing in these terms. So it could well be that before the atomic bomb dropped, if it's going to drop, that the ecology would annihilate the human race. That's a possibility. But it's also a possibility that man will come to his senses. That's what we're in the business for, isn't it? Aren't we saying that the way out is it to introduce a new set of social relationships? Now, the fact is that what we should be doing is concerning ourselves about that factor. Never mind whether it's going to be an optimistic or a pessimistic attitude. The fact is that that is the solution, and that's the only activity that is worthwhile. The speculation as to whether it's going to succeed, in my view, is beside the point. Of course we are hoping it's going to succeed, but something must be done about it. And people are not doing anything about it. It's only us that are doing anything worthwhile about it, and possibly we're not doing what we as much as we should be doing. But we've come to an interpretation which we think is a correct interpretation of the world in which we're living, and we're saying that we've got to try and change the attitude of people in order to get a new set of social relationships. In other words, where you can have a different kind of behaviour because you've got a different basis for human existence. You've got a cooperative basis, except instead of an antagonistic one. Capitalism is an antagonistic order of society with all its cooperation. Socialism is a cooperative society without antagonisms of that kind. So that's what we're concerned about. And in the solution will be the solution of all these things that the ecologists and the anthropologists and others are talking about. So it's not a question of we must be pessimistic. Christ, if we must be pessimistic, you may as well run across Oxford Street with blindfold in the hopes that a bus will hit you. That's the kind of pessimism that you're talking about.
Well, I've been come around saying it's better for propaganda reasons to use the pessimistic view.
Well, I don't agree with that. I don't hold that view at all.
Very encouraging.
You've got to try and show the need for an optimistic attitude in developing socialism, in getting people to understand that that is what is required.
If you say you're pessimistic, does it not mean that unless people do change the whole social relations that you're talking about, then they will die, and you know, the whole society will die?
Yeah, but that's not taking a pessimistic view. That's taking an objective assessment.
That's right. So you've got to say to people, look, your existence is insecure.
Yeah, but you see, the pessimistic view would be to say that your position is insecure and there's nothing that can be done about it. Yeah. That's the pessimistic view.
Is that what he's saying?
No, he's not saying that. Oh, no.
Let's try and put it into before any other contribution comes. You see, it's just not good enough, you know, to state the socialist case. Okay? What you've got to remember is that you've got to encourage people to be pessimistic about all sorts of things that are happening in capitalism at the present time, for them, you know, to question everything. Huh? It's not just a matter of putting over the socialist case.
We can do that anyway.
That's not the pessimism I'm talking about. But pessimism, yeah, that's what I'd like to know now at this stage. Yeah.
I think that's the question. It's a mad load of definition. I mean, what do you mean by pessimistic?
What he's trying to say is that.
I could say, I think that there are two reasons for not having pessimism as part of our propaganda, and it does fit in with this question of human behaviour. One is, I do not agree with Tom Rain Wilson, I think others, who said about, well, if we don't get socialism, everyone's going to die and there's going to be this sort of social Armageddon, because I don't think that is good propaganda. In fact, recently, it's been very tempting to talk about the possibility of a Third World War, the possibility of all kinds of threats to people's security. I don't think that makes good propaganda. That is a kind of revelationary propaganda where you come along and shout, the end is at hand, either join us now or let's come. Capitalism isn't like that. Capitalism can go on for a bloody hell of a long time. In fact, the founders of this party, if anything, suffered from that kind of pessimism about capitalism. Marx himself suffered from that kind of pessimism about capitalism, and they thought it would end. They thought that the acute conflict between socialism and capitalist consciousness would hit the working class much sooner than it has. But capitalism can reform its way out of these problems, it can accommodate workers to the system, and it can turn their pessimism into optimism. And this has happened. That's one reason why it shouldn't. The other reason why it shouldn't is I don't believe that by simply saying to members of the working class, socialism offers an alternative to a whole set of negative things which you should feel pessimistic about and defeatist about and can't do anything about within capitalism, I don't think that is the kind of thing which, and this is, you know, obviously here we're talking about personal speculation because none of us have been great successes in getting hundreds of people into the party, me or George, but all we can say is that socialism offers something optimistic, positive, and to try and talk about the kind of society that socialism could produce and the kind of immediacy with which it could produce that kind of alternative. That, I believe, is optimism. The definition of pessimism is very similar to the definition of defeatism. Because as soon as you say, be pessimistic about things, I think that you are putting up barriers to the possibilities of being able to do anything. If you're pessimistic about the problems, then it means that the problems are of such a nature that you can't actually tackle them, at least immediately. I think optimistically, what we can say is that we as socialists are optimistic in the face of anything. Because after all, if there's unemployment, you'll always get one branch member coming along saying, the workers are unemployed, they're going to turn to socialism. If there's full employment, there's another branch member who comes along and says, the workers are much more prepared to listen when they're in work because they haven't got unemployment to think about. Practically any occurrence, if there's good weather, you'll get a socialist saying, good weather for outdoor meetings. If there's bad weather, you'll get another branch member saying, you'll stick leaflets through their doors, they can't go out, they won't take to read. You can't. If you have pictures on the front cover, you'll have a member saying, this is going to do the trick. Take pictures off the front cover. You'll have another one saying, they've got a whole page more of writing now, they're going to read this. This extra page is going to make socialism. I mean, we socialists are optimists. If we weren't optimists, and I'm talking about not only rational optimism, but a kind of sentimental optimism, which some of us might not like. If we couldn't get up on a wet morning, go out to Hyde Park, go out to distribute leaflets or sell the stamp or whatever else members are doing, and not be optimistic, then, as Harry says, maybe we wouldn't go and stand in the middle of Oxford Street waiting for a bus to come and knock us down. In fact, the one thing that won't knock you down in the middle of Oxford Street is a bus, from my experience. You won't find one. But certainly, the one thing that we might as well do is give up the possibility of bringing about socialism. And although I don't accuse Conway Wilson of this in particular, or even generally, I think he has articulated what is one of the serious problems of the party in two respects. One was that when the party was formed, they had the incorrect assumption that socialism would be forced upon the working class much sooner than it has been. And I think we've now all come to the much more mature recognition that history, with a capital H, is not going to force socialism onto the working class. It's going to have to be a conscious decision of the working class in the face of a system that can, in fact, accommodate many of their disagreements with it. And also, I think it's a problem of the party at the moment, insofar as I think there is a pessimism about socialism, and a pessimism which borders on defeatism, which turns occasional socialist propaganda into such simple cynicism, where you attack this and you attack that, and very often the positive aspects of the party's position are lost in it. And this does lead me to a question about this, which I obviously have my own answer to, and I think we would all have a similar answer to, but I think it's worth posing. You say, as a socialist, we would all say, that the creation of a new kind of society requires a different pattern of behaviour. But at the same time, we all recognise that the new kind of society will in itself inaugurate the new kind of behaviour. This is a problem about consciousness, which in fact I hope we're going to discuss next week in the talk on history and whether socialism is historically inevitable. But I hope that everyone recognises that it is a problem. And it's a problem which embraces such sticky areas of politics like reformism.
Right.
Because the question you have to ask yourself is, at what stage do the working class have to progress to before we can have socialism? And then, is that stage which the working class going to progress to, is it going to be possible within a society which we say determines antisocial behaviour? So how, in other words, do the contradictions of capitalism provide a kind of socialist political awareness on the part of the working class? And then how far is socialism going to have to take that political awareness after we've actually got it.
Yeah, well, I'm...
But before you answer that, will you take Comrade Coleman to task? Just the same way you took me to task, well, regarding my pessimism, will you take Comrade Coleman to task regarding his optimism?
Well, I mean, the way in which I was using the term was that when I said I don't take the pessimistic view or the optimistic view, I was taking the extreme position of people that say, all right, well, we're going towards destruction, but there's nothing that you can do about it. That's the kind of pessimism that some people have got. And the optimism that says, all right, well, everything will come right in the end without us doing anything about it. That's what I meant by the pessimistic attitude in relation to further development. Now, what Steve Coleman is talking about is, again, I mean, I know that this, we're accused of being esoteric and all the rest of it, but this, again, is an illustration of Marx's philosophical concepts in relation to historical materialism. You see, there is an apparent contradiction. You've got to have different behaviour before you get different behaviour, as it were. But the fact is that if the concept of the Hegelian concept of thesis, antithesis and synthesis mean anything at all, it means that within the framework of one particular order of society will grow the antithesis to that order of society. Now, the degree to which that grows and the extent to which it grows will determine the qualitative change. Now, I know that this may appear to be just a lot of jargon which doesn't apply, but I don't see any other way that this can operate, because you see, it's quite true that the kind of behavior is determined socially, but so are the ideas that come forth about altering behavior. They are also engendered, and the process is a relatively slow one on the basis of a quantitative change which speeds up. This is how I see it. There is a speeding up of the process, much as there is in evolutionary processes, whatever they are, and a time will come when the practical proposition can be a fact. In other words, society would have progressed sufficiently enough to say, right, that's the finish. We're now really going to do something about it. We're going to take over political power. We've got sufficient support. We've got sufficient idea. There's been sufficient development along these lines, even although we're still within the framework of capitalism. And I can't visualise that process taking place without capitalism itself being modified to a great extent. I think that that's the time that reformism will start to operate. You'll really get reforms operating then, because it will be a practical proposition. And then of course, you have a qualitative change. That's how I see it. You see, I appreciate what you're saying, because it is rather difficult. And this is one of the questions that's very often put at the park. They say, well, all right, the workers are supporting capitalism, and it's capitalist ideology that they are oriented along the lines. How do you alter it? How do you get them to institute socialism? Well, the answer is you've got to get them thinking along those lines. And we think along those lines, but we're still subject to capitalism, and a lot of us still behave in some respects in a capitalist way, irrespective of our socialist ideas. There's more in it than meets the eye. It's not merely a question of getting rid of your prejudices like that. This is a very gradual process, I think.
Well, what I've got to say, as you were saying, they give you reform in proper. It's started a little bit now, hasn't it? There it is, in some sense. they cushion you up quite a lot, such as golden handshakes. In the 1930s, would you get that? I don't think so. Even national health, though they cut it down a bit, but by God, that's cushioning.
Yeah, but there's no realisation on the part of the people that are subject to the reforms of anything different. And not only that, but it is illustrated, I think, by experience, that the reformism of capitalism, whilst capitalism lasts, doesn't last very long. You've got an example of that in the National Health Scheme. It's quite true that there have been forced upon the capitalist class, very often for pragmatic reasons, purely pragmatic reasons, that they've instituted certain reforms that are beneficial. Obviously, it's far better to have a situation where at least you get perhaps one or two meals a day rather than not being able to get anything. I mean, that obviously is an advantage, but it doesn't... The people in receipt of that reform are not in the position of viewing society in any other way. We're talking about a situation where workers ideologically are becoming socialist. And consequently, in order to fob off the inevitable, which will gradually become the inevitable, then the capitalist class are more likely to institute reforms. Whether they can be sustained by capitalism will be another added reason why capitalism should go, as far as the working class are concerned. The working class at the moment do not think on lines which are anything but inimical to their own interests. That's the tragedy of the thing.